So we heard on the news this morning that you've lost your fight for the Senate seat here in New South Wales. What's your reaction to that loss of fight?
My reaction is that I'm not the least bit surprised. For overseas people, they need to understand the intricacies of the Australian electoral system, which many Australians don't understand. But simply speaking, all the political parties who were standing candidates for the Senate chose to give their preferences to all the other political parties, bar the Nuclear Disarmament Party, with the exception of myself. So in other words, for a candidate to get elected, he must receive a certain number of primary votes. If he fails in achieving that maximum number of primary votes, he requires on secondary votes from the other parties. I didn't receive any from anybody else, so it was very difficult for me to get elected.
But the votes that you actually got from the populace, the people of Sydney and the people of the state of New South Wales, was very large and a very plausible vote, wasn't it?
That's right, yes. In actual fact, we polled 300,000 primary votes here, and our nearest opponent, who in fact has become elected, only polled 222,000 votes. And I think Australia-wide, the Nuclear Disarmament Party polled in excess of 600,000 votes. And a good number of that vote was really a vote for Peter Garrett as well, because in many of the other states the candidates weren't that well known. So the vote has been very, very strong here. But unfortunately, because of the dirty tricking of the other political parties, they've prevented me from sitting in the upper house.
It does seem a very unfair voting system that the people on the street that voted for you in good faith, hoping that you would represent them in the Senate, have not been given the right of their vote, and that the preference system at a higher level of government has changed that, because politicians, it would seem from what you're saying, decided they don't want you in the Senate, they don't want the things that you have to say to have any effect on the rest of the Senate.
That's partly true, but I think it's misleading to say that it's undemocratic. What's happened here in Australia is that we have a very complicated system of proportional representation for the Senate, which means that unless people actually exercise their opportunity to determine what order of they want to rate political candidates, then they end up just voting for the party as a whole and accepting the preferences that the party machine itself dictates. That's what happened in New South Wales, so that people conveniently chose to vote for the party of their choice and assume that I would get a vote somewhere along the way, and in fact I'd been put to the very end. It's more of a reflection of the nature of the system here than the fact that it's undemocratic, I think.
Do you think, though, even though you've lost your fight for the Senate in this race, that you have made people in New South Wales, and indeed across Australia, and maybe the world, do you think you've made them more aware of the issues that you were fighting?
Very definitely. I think we've had a historic and remarkable achievement in the period of time when we ran in the election. At the beginning of the election campaign, the Prime Minister in Australia and the other government leaders were not talking about the issues of disarmament or peace. They were not addressing them at all. They were ignoring them. By the time the campaign had finished, disarmament had become the central issue. We even had the spectre of the Liberal Party leader, the Conservative Party leader, talking about how strong his record on disarmament was. So in that sense, I think we've achieved a great deal. We're very, very, very happy with it. We've got a long way to go, but we've certainly upped the ante in Australia as far as the nuclear debate's concerned, and that was the aim of the exercise.
Had you got in, you would have been the first rock star, pop star, what have you, to have made it to a government position, to a position of authority where you would have represented in some decision-making the thoughts and feelings of a lot of people. Do you think it was because you are Peter Garrett, lead vocalist with the Australian group Midnight Oil, that got you as far as you did?
No, I don't think so. I think that what happened was that a lot of people out there who have not heard any politician or any political figure speak about disarmament, speak about the arms race, talk about what government should do and what government action should be undertaken, were surprised and excited to have someone speak in that way. I think that we did get a lot of votes from young people who are disillusioned and disenfranchised and feel that politics doesn't mean anything for them and are sick of living under the shadow of the bomb. But at the same time, it's very clear to us that we got a great deal of support right across the board, because I was out there saying my bit and people were responding to it.
In terms of world politics, we talk about nuclear power, nuclear defence, between two powers, really, between Russia and America. At the moment, their representatives are fighting it out in Geneva at high-level talks. Australia, to some extent, doesn't play any part. Perhaps Britain does a little bit because of its natural alliance and its location in the Northern Hemisphere. Do you think that your fight has made people more aware of the issues both in Australia and abroad?
I think so, but I think that the important thing about the Nuclear Disarmament Party and my candidature was this. We have inherited a nuclear world. Australia is as much a part of the nuclear world as West Germany or the United Kingdom or America is. We host American bases here. We allow the Americans to use our ports and our airfields for the landing and the service of their nuclear-powered and nuclear-weaponed ships. And we are part of an alliance which is involved and has nuclear warfighting strategies in with it. And so consequently, I think many Australians weren't aware of this. I think that many people in other parts of the world weren't aware of how heavily nuclearised the Pacific has become and what a crucial role Australia plays. And we found out yesterday that our base called Pine Gap here provides the central communication link between the new spy satellites which the Americans are intending to place over Russia at the end of this month. Obviously, this makes it a very, very high priority target, and that's now admitted by the Americans. But the point of the matter is this. This nuclear spectre is starting to haunt us wherever we are. People can no longer think about going to New Zealand or Australia or Tasmania to get away from it, because we're just as much a part of it as the rest of the world is. I think Australians now recognise this, and I'm hoping that they're going to do something about it.
What about your alliance with countries like Germany in the Bundestag, where Petra Kelly of the Green Party is now a member of the government in that country now?
I'm not sure that she's a member of the government,
but yes.
I think that we have a natural alliance with the Greens, obviously, from our nuclear issue and from all that derives from that. And I think that what you saw happen in Australia, we are going to see increasingly happen in other parts of the world as well, which has come from the Greens, and that is people who are concerned about their future are no longer prepared to sit back and allow the classic old vested interest political parties to continue to ruin the planet and to place us all at risk. Young people are feeling that they must have some kind of say over their destiny. If they can't see that happening in old political parties, then they're going to gravitate to new political parties. I think that the appearance of the Nuclear Disarmament Party comes partly as a result of the Greens, but partly as a reflection in Australia of people's dissatisfaction with government policy on the issue of disarmament. Whether we now develop a Greens Party here or not remains to be seen. I hope that we will in time, because I think that there's a place for it. I think there's a need for sensible politics, real politics, not the politics of exploitation and oppression, and now's the time for it.
Now, your interests have extended beyond nuclear disarmament. You talk about exploitation. I guess Australia is one of the vast continents in the world where a lot of exploitation of its minerals and natural resources is taking place. There's vast areas of the outback I've become aware of since being here where heavy mining is going on. And it's something that I know you've taken an interest in. Although your banner is the NDP, it is beyond that, is it not?
Well, in terms of the lyrics that I've written for Midnight Oil and the talks and stuff that I've done in the past, yes, it's true that I have a very strong concern about what has actually happened in Australia and how it relates to the rest of the world. Because we've only been settled in Australia, white settlers, for 200 years, it's a very short time span for us to see what we've done. We oppressed the black Aboriginal Australians when we got here, and now we allow and have allowed the country to be destroyed and despoiled in the name of profit. And for the most part, we've allowed overseas multinational companies to come in and take a part of it. And this is something which I think is wrong and something that I've always spoken out very strongly against.
Being a member of an opposition party, as you are, and a minority party at that, you really can't be that effective in terms of changing laws at a national and international level. Is it the idea of yourself and members of your party in this country to have a more of a lobby effect on the other minority parties in government, if you like?
Partly it is, although I don't think it's true to say that we can't affect laws. I think that by lobbying we can affect laws, and I think that's the most important thing, is to feel that you can affect the way decisions are made in a country. If you decide that you can't affect them, and in a sense you're opting out, you're not becoming an anarchist, you're just becoming a nothingist, and you're allowing those things to go on which you may disagree with. You need to be involved. I think that the Nuclear Disarmament Party is a ginger group. I think that what it's really seeking to do is to place the issue of disarmament high on the agenda and to keep it there, to focus people's attention on the fact that the issue is important and that they want their politicians to do something about it, and then draw politicians' attention to the fact that there are people who want action taken. At the same time, I think that effectiveness, in a sense, in this way, operates like this. We live in a nuclear world. The build-up of nuclear weapons, which is occurring at this present time and which has been taking place since 1946, presents us all with a very, very real and very great crisis. As people become more aware of this, they are starting to take steps to do something about it. The Nuclear Disarmament Party in Australia is just one of those many steps which have been taken by people everywhere. I believe that it's the start of a large wave. I believe that this large wave is going to grow and grow and grow, and I believe eventually we are going to interconnect. We're going to interconnect in a spiritual sense, and we're going to interconnect in a moral sense, and we're going to interconnect in a political sense. Once that interconnectedness starts to take place, then we will see very strong pressures of popular opinion being levelled directly at politicians, who will then have to consider it. In the meantime, it seems like there's lots of disparate actions occurring all over the world. But once these things start to mesh, the effect will be very, very strong.
You've lost this political round to gain a seat in the Senate, but obviously your convictions haven't been destroyed or defeated. Does this mean, because you've lost this political round, that you'll give up fighting and trying to gain a Senate seat, or will you try again next time round?
Well, I didn't decide initially to fight a Senate seat. I was approached to stand as a candidate, and I agreed to stand because I wanted to run a candidacy that would attract a large number of people, and I think that we've succeeded in doing that. And I really feel that we've had great success, and I'm not just saying that. I'm not bitter about not getting in at all. It would have been a great bonus to get in. It would have meant a radical change to my lifestyle, of course, to go and to stand in Parliament, but we did succeed. Now, as far as what my involvement politically will be in the future, that's up to the people who've approached me in the past to determine. If people want me to serve, then I'll serve. My heart, my mind and my body is for disarmament and peace. And I'm there and I'm ready. And I have a band that I play with and I perform with who support that and who supported me during this campaign. So I think that you will just have to see what happens in the future for that one.
Well, 85's just started, and we've heard the announcement on the news, on the radio and TV in Australia that you've lost your fight for the Senate seat here in New South Wales. Now, I read an article, Peter, where you were quoted as saying that you would still keep both things going if you made it into Senate and went to represent people in this state of Australia. You'd still keep your interests in Midnight Oil going. Well, now we know that you've lost your Senate fight. What will that mean to your position with the band? Will it mean you'll be concentrating more on music?
Well, probably a little more than I would have had I gone to Canberra as a senator. I think really that for the Oils, we've reached a stage of our career where we've definitely achieved just about everything that we could ever have wanted to achieve in our own country. We've spent some time overseas where we've had mixed and measured success. I think that, personally, my own feeling is that everything that I want Midnight Oil to do, I want it to be doing with a view to disarmament and to peace. Because I'm not going to Canberra, it means that I'll be pushing the Oils harder in that direction. But I've got a lot of other things on my plate as well, so it's going to be a bit of a balancing act for me, I think.
One of the interesting correlations between yourselves and your political beliefs is that, in a sense, your political beliefs are purist beliefs in a world, a utopian world, some could say, yours an idyllic. There's that side of it, but there's also the fact that Midnight Oil are phenomenally successful. The album 10 to 1, or 109876, etc., is still in the charts. I think it's been in the charts for nearly 2 years here in Australia. The new album that you released in October 84, Red Sails in the Sunsets, double platinum, and there's that whole capitalist side to it, the commercial side of Midnight Oil. Seems a bit of a contradiction to me.
Well, I think the thing about it is that sort of success, especially 10 to 1 success, has come as a bigger surprise to us as it has to anyone. I mean, I don't think we ever expected that. The issue being, I guess, that Midnight Oil's raison d'etre has never been to chase success. It's been to create music that it believed in. And along the way, it's never been prepared to compromise its position or its feelings about its music to actually achieve success. This has meant taking backward steps in terms of career, but for us, it's always meant keeping our own faith in ourselves as performers and songwriters. The fact that we've had a very great success here, I don't think is a contradiction for what we stand for, because we're writing about those things which are important and we try and conduct ourselves in the way that we suggest on our albums. I think it's just very fortuitous and very lucky for us, otherwise we'd probably have to go back and get jobs.
Well, now, the two albums I mentioned, 10 to 1 and Red Sails, are the most recent albums and the ones most visible to people, both in Australia and abroad, as you mentioned. But before that, I wonder whether Midnight Oil, the band themselves, wrote songs and felt as strongly about the issues that are contained within the lyrics today.
Ever since we started in 1977, we've had a very, very strong feeling about certain things, which we call the issues that affect us, the issues that we see when we walk out our front door. And we've always written songs about those things. In 1978, when we were a bunch of grotty-nosed little poor bandos from the northern beaches of Sydney, we weren't getting jobs in some of the pubs and clubs in New South Wales because we wouldn't accept the practices which were going on there. And we found ourselves playing the only concerts which were available to us, which were benefit concerts, which we wanted to play. And in 1978, with Mental as Anything, we played a Movement Against Uranium Mining concert at Sydney Town Hall, which marked the beginning of our political performance career. It's been a big part of the band all the time, and I think it always will be a big part of the band. But we've never seen ourselves in the light of being political, which in a sense is why running for the Senate was a logical thing for me to do. I have got to the position where I don't feel I can hector the audience about SS-20s or ICBM missiles or nuclear treaties or things like this from the stage. I don't think that's the place to do it. I saw that there was an avenue available to go and argue these political matters in a political context, and I was happy to do it. Midnight Oil expresses itself in a musical context by talking about those issues which affect us. It always has done, and it always will do. I can't remember the question.
It was a good answer anyway. It was quite a sufficient answer. In Australia, you grew in popularity, performing in front of teenagers, young folk that enjoy rock and roll. It's interesting to me, intriguing, that Australia was receptive to your music. In Britain, where there's high unemployment, where there's a lot of pollution, where there's a very urban environment, and perhaps in Europe and to some extent in America, groups like UB40, The Jam, Paul Weller, individuals in the pop music world there have been more successful, with an audience more receptive. Is it as receptive here in Australia? Do you think the people that listen to your music are listening to what you're singing? Or is it the dynamics and the show, the presentation, that they're really enjoying?
Always a difficult question to answer, and I've never been there in the audience to know what people are responding to. My feeling is that many of our audience have come to us because we were a very strong live band who played very hard and who played as if they meant it and who were consistent and who obviously meant business. And I think that we gained an audience, especially in the early days, a hard rock, semi-punk audience, if you like, for playing very strongly and not mucking about. As far as our lyric content goes, I really don't know how many people take the word as gospel, and they're not meant to. It's just our attitudes, and I don't mind if they don't. People can come to a Midnight Oil show and dance and enjoy themselves. I guess that a lot of people do, though, just from the mail that we receive. It seems that a lot of people do take what we are saying to heart. I don't think Australian kids as a whole are as political as their European or American counterparts. Well, no, their European counterparts, partly because there's no tradition or history here of political struggle at all. I think that they are concerned about the environment and about nuclear war, like most people are. But I think that they come to Midnight Oil, in a sense, because it's a shared experience. Midnight Oil's career was made by its audience. It wasn't made by radio or made by a record company or made by industries or businesses. It was made by its audience and its own efforts. And that shared knowledge, which has become very wide now, has meant that Midnight Oil and its audience have always had a strong relationship. When we've spoken about things of substance and talked about the issues which concern us, some of them sort of, yes, nod and say, OK, we know that you're on about this, and others say, great, you know, they respond to it very strongly.
I'm told of the concerts, and I haven't seen Midnight Oil, which is sad for me at the moment, but I'm sure I'll get the chance at some point in the future. I'm told of the concerts that they're both dynamic for people to see and exhausting for the band to perform.
Well, I think that they're dynamic for people to see in the sense that we have always done it, you know, like the way that we've always felt it should be done. You know, we've instinctively, I guess, but now also with a certain amount of theatre and with as much effort and energy as we can do. And our music has always had a very strong energy base. Robert Hurst, drummer and songwriter in Midnight Oil, is a very, very strong drummer, very visually very strong as well. And the energies on stage have tended to now coalesce into a very strong performance of the music that we play, as well as that nowadays we put a fair amount of our time and money into actually presenting a production which makes sense, but which is visually exciting for people as well, without too much blah and over-the-top nothingness. And we play for a long time and we go really hard at it. We believe that those 2 hours are the most precious 2 hours of the day for us and for the people that are there. And we've never been able to really understand people that sort of stroll on stage as if they're doing everybody a favour, sort of hang up there quite coolly and loosely in their latest trendy gear and do their songs and then sort of roll off again with a few bit of sweat coming off. I mean, I think comparisons are very odious in this context, but I think that in terms of the way that we like to perform, there are bands and performers that get close to it, and the Clash and Springsteen are two that obviously come to mind, and they're also artists which in different hemispheres or different countries, different continents come to mind in terms of parallels as well. There is a shared thing within those three artists of a commitment to perform and a bonding between audience and band which is total.
You mentioned about the touring of the band, that it was touring and not radio airplays or TV exposure that really broke Midnight Oil in Australia. I know that at certain points in your career, TV didn't want to know anything about you. In particular, I think the show Countdown, which is, I suppose it's as popular here as Top of the Pops is in Britain. And I think that they at one point then said, yes, well, we're prepared to accept you, but on our terms. Now, I do hear Midnight Oil singles on the radio now, and I see you on TV. Does this mean that you've all reached a compromise, or do you think the media and the people that organise it have finally said, we'll welcome you in on your terms?
Yeah, that's what happened. We were prepared to stick it out as long as was necessary to actually determine the way we were promoted and the way we were used by TV. We wanted to set the conditions for our performances, and there was a lot of resistance to that. People didn't believe that musicians should have that kind of say over their career, and we were ignored as a result of it. In time, of course, partly I think due to the success in terms of our live popularity, they came to recognise that we couldn't be ignored any longer, and now we're in a fortunate position of actually being able to determine how we perform and not accepting conditions from people wearing suits who sit in offices.
If your songs are played on the radio now as part of a format, and Australian FM stations in particular lean a little bit towards the American format, perhaps they may play more songs and talk less, but nevertheless they play similar kind of AOR album-orientated music. If your songs are nestled in between bands who have catchy songs but aren't necessarily saying anything, do you think that you're losing the effect of what you're really trying to get across to people?
I don't think so. I think that the song should say it if people are listening to it, and if it's jumping at them, I think the song should say it. And it doesn't. It's never really bothered us where we appear, and I certainly don't have anything against people that write banal, simple, meaningless, mindless pop ditties. It's just that they don't hold any appeal for me. They may for other people, and I certainly don't mind to hear Midnight Oil songs in the middle of it because they sound real to me. So no, I don't think that that's a problem.
Talking about songwriting now, you were mentioning Rob Hurst, the drummer, who's a very dramatic drummer and plays a major part in the stage performance. I think he also has determined a lot of the way the songs are written. He writes songs. I think Shaman's Boxers is a song he wrote about the Aborigine boxers that came down from the Northern Territories.
Well, I think that's the other lucky thing about Midnight Oil, and for me especially lucky, is that you know you've got a couple of good songwriters in the band, Rob Hurst and Jim Magini. And Rob has always played a role in the band. He formed Midnight Oil, and he remembers going out to sea, as many young Australians would, circus or fairs, which we had in the 60s and the 50s. And one of the particular attractions was called the Jimmy Sharman's Boxing Tent, which was a tent with a boxing ring inside. And you paid to go in and see members of the public fight against the boxing troupe, which was for the most part made up of Aboriginals. And of course in the early days the Aboriginal boxers were very badly paid, and quite often they would be ill-matched against larger, heftier Australian versions who perhaps they could box better than, but to equalise the fight and make it exciting for the people, they were mismatched. And he's written this song, which I think is a very, very strong, very, very worthwhile historical piece, for want of a better way of putting it, without seeming too weighty, about those particular times.
How do you get together with songs? Because they are about serious issues in some ways, although I think you try to humorise it to make it more acceptable to people. But do you have great philosophical, semantic arguments over a cup of tea before you arrive at a decision whether to record the song or not?
Not really, no. We might talk for a bit about it, but I wouldn't call them philosophical discussions. What really happens, I think, is that Robert or myself, or sometimes Jim, will have a lyric which everyone will like, and that'll just go. If there's one which everyone doesn't like, then we might talk about it a little bit. But there's never a sense of people pushing stuff around, and usually there's a sense of something making sense in the Midnight Oil context. I mean, I think that our themes, for want of a better way of putting it, without again seeming too serious about it, have been fairly consistent. And those themes are natural things for me to sing about. I mean, Rob Hurst might write a pop song. He has. In fact, he wrote General's Talk on the Red Sails album, which I just didn't feel comfortable singing a line like that. I'm happy for him to sing it. I don't think that there are any particular rules or things with the way that the Oils operate. We just go about it however we can, and whatever comes up, comes up.
In terms of commercial success in Australia, you've more than made your point here. With both 10 to 1 and Red Sails, you're well clear of making your mark. Overseas, though, it's a different story altogether, and to some extent, I think it would be true to say that the Oils have had a difficult time in America because it's a very right-wing political country, a different climate politically to others, and maybe that has filtered across, what you have to say rather than what you sound like has filtered across first, and has been a hindrance to your success and furthering your career in that continent.
That's definitely true. I think that there was a resistance in America for a long time when we were making records, simply because they didn't make any sense to American people and the American programmers and record people. And also, of course, there was this very strong, stubborn bunch of Aussies who weren't going to change them particularly. We have a tradition of bands going from Australia to America and doing very well. In the early days, Air Supply and Little River Band are two good examples of bands that achieved that, who've adopted really an American sound and gone with it. We have always been far more idiosyncratic in our approach. And I think the only way around that is to get out and do an enormous amount of touring. And we've always felt that the band would lose its spark, that we would just become another one of those Hello Omaha, This Must Be Tuesday bands. And so we've tended not to go out and flog ourselves to death and treat our music just like a bit of plastic and a bit of product. And so consequently, as a result of that, we've only sort of gone through cult and college level. We haven't had the sort of major breakthroughs that other people want for us. The other thing about it, though, is that we haven't wanted the success. We haven't ever gone out of our way to become a successful band in America. We never really intended to that our records would be released there. We would be happy for them to be released, just as we would be happy for them to be released in other places. But our sense of worth and our sense of making sense as people and as musicians and as artists has always come from connecting in our own environment, which was Australia. And we always felt that Australian bands can be universal and internationalist, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that personally, we saw ourselves as being a very Australian band, and so we felt that we made sense here, and if it was difficult for us to make sense in other places, well, then we just have to wait for other people to catch up.
It's interesting you say that about Australia and the fact that you're more determined to be successful or get your message across in Australia, and if other countries get a bit of the information into their society, that's a good thing. In America, I would have thought it was tempting for you, Peter, to have some degree of success there because they, like Russia, are the two world powers that create so many of the things that you are singing about, that you're singing against.
Yes, and that was why we went to America in 1984, not because we wanted to get on the plane and go and sit in LA for 2 or 3 weeks, but because we felt that it was important for us to be seen, to be playing those songs and to talk to the press about the songs, the music and the politics and the issues. And I mean, I want to go to America in that sense to talk about it and to talk to Americans, and I get on well with American people and I enjoy being in that country. It's a very positive, very strong place. I think that they have a lot of misconceptions about how the rest of the world sees them, and I think that performers and artists can help achieve those communication levels which propaganda and politicians sometimes build up as bridges against, as barriers against. At the same time, I'm not prepared to go there and allow myself to be flogged around like a Barbie doll, and neither is the band. And so it's a case of us feeling our way. And I think that as people discover us in America, we have a small audience there, then more Americans discover us in time, and the thing hopefully is organic and grows.
Let's come back to your recorded work now and talk a little bit about 10 to 1 and Red Sails in the Sunset, more recent album released at the end of 84. 10 to 1 was recorded in London, right?
Yes, that's right. We did 10 to 1 in 1982. In fact, we'd been to London the year before and recorded A Place Without a Postcard album with Glyn Johns in his studio in Sussex. And we decided that we would like to go back because we realised that recording there was probably a little bit further on down the line than it was in Australia, especially in terms of in-house staff and producers and engineers. We recorded at the Townhouse Studios in Shepherd's Bush with Nick Launay, who up to that time had worked with diverse people such as Public Image and Kate Bush and others. And that album, of course, was the first time that Midnight Oil had actually been able to spend more than about 3.5 weeks in a studio. And so we actually spent 5 or 6 weeks making a record for the first time, which was very important for us, and which achieved a fair amount of success here and in different patches around the world. That album stayed on the charts, went to sleep up there, which shocked us intensely and meant that we didn't have to go out and make another one. And so it wasn't until late last year, or the middle of last year, 84, that we got around to doing another one.
And which took you to Japan.
That's right. We went. We decided that we'd like to record outside of Australia because it lets us look back, and also it gives us an opportunity to send postcards home to our friends and make them terribly envious. And we went to Tokyo to record Red Sails in the Sunset. In fact, Martin Rotzi plays guitar in Midnight Oil, had lived in Japan for a year and a half when he was a schoolboy, and had always spoken very highly of it. 10 to 1 had come out in Japan and had an audience there, and we felt that Australia, if we were going to go anywhere, we'd go Asian, because we feel that Australia is very much a part of the Pacific Asian region, and Japan has such a strong effect on the rest of the world, and yet so few people actually know what goes on in Japan. We thought, well, we'll go and find out. We'll make a record there. What a great way of doing it. See Japan as well and learn to master the chopsticks. So, yes, we did Red Sails in Tokyo in June and July of this year.
Were there other reasons, perhaps, for going to Japan to record the album? Because Japan, you know, had the bomb dropped on it in the war, and you obviously are against such things.
Well, I mean, I was for spending all that amount of money to go there to make the record as well, because it enabled me to go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in fact, I attended the August 6th anniversary and peace conference, World Peace Conference, that takes place every year in Japan, in Tokyo, then in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki in 1984, and I'm going to go back this year too as well. And I had an opportunity to meet with the Japanese peace groups, to meet with the Hibakusha, who are the victims groups there, and to get some understanding of what had actually happened then. So it had a dual purpose, I guess.
The sound of the album is different to 10 to 1. It's a bit more acoustic, lighter sounding. It's not as heavy. Was that something you did on purpose, or was that a result of the recording process?
I think that was done on purpose. I think that Midnight Oil has always been tagged as being a guitar band, a hard rock band, and we do play hard, there's no doubt about it, and we play with guitars and we love it, but there is another side to us which I think comes about basically from having people who have been playing for a long time and are good players but who don't want to play technically well but like to play lots of instruments and get different sounds out of them. And we're always chasing some kind of feel which, I guess, for want of a better way of describing it, combines the technological sophistication that you've got in the studio and what you can do with it with more of a primitive, earthy sort of heart sound, which we feel comes from acoustic instruments. So we were sort of going for an acoustic instrument in a very, very good studio mix.
With, what, 5 albums behind you now, you've used British producers, Glyn Johns, Nick Launay. I wondered whether you would like to do the albums yourselves in the future, perhaps produce your own Midnight Oil album. You can do it now. You could probably afford it, no doubt.
Well, I don't know whether we can afford it. Maybe we can, yeah. I don't reckon many bands produce themselves that well, because they're too close to it. I mean, a producer's a referee, it seems to me, as much as anything else. And a band like Midnight Oil, where everyone's got very strong opinions, you need a referee. I think that some of us would probably like to have a go at doing something like that in the future, simply because once you've spent, you know, sort of cumulative 5 or 6 albums of time in a studio, you get to feel your way around a little bit. And in fact, we may do it. It's always been important for us to work with people who allow us a very equal say, and the albums have all been co-produced, more or less, except for the Glyn Johns one, where co-production was absolutely out of the question. And in fact, you can hear a lot of Jim Magini on Red Sails in the Sunset, because he spends a lot of time there fiddling the knobs.
Being the front man and in many ways the spokesperson for Midnight Oil, you're recognised very easily, and I would have thought life in Sydney means that you can't really go out in a public place without being confronted by your fans, people that know you. How do you feel about that side of your career, the public side of it, and not having anonymity when you'd like it at times?
I guess it's just one of the things that comes with having a degree of success and looking reasonably different, and I certainly wouldn't complain about it, because I enjoy to talk to people out there, Midnight Oil fans, about the band. But I must admit, in the last couple of years, as it's grown, it's made it much harder for me to actually go out and just hang around, which is one way of getting your inspiration. And I would never want to write songs about sort of sitting looking at the walls, or you know, eating in a restaurant or whatever. And I guess we're looking at some form of wig, really, in 1985 to remedy this situation.
When you do meet people on the street who know you, I know that you don't push them away. You do talk to them. Now, if they look at you and talk to you because you're Peter Garrett, Midnight Oil rock star, and not Peter Garrett, political candidate, believer of some serious issues in the world, do you try to convert them away from just looking at you as a musician, pop star?
Well, it depends how long we're talking. But I generally find that fans just want to say g'day, really, and just be recognised and acknowledged, and I'm really happy to do that, and I just say g'day back. If someone wants to have a talk and they want to talk about the issues or the band, then sure, I'll make the points that I want to make. I think that in Australia, the people have got a very healthy attitude towards so-called stars. We don't really have a star system here, and people tend to be very down-to-earth in this country, which is very refreshing. You don't get all the sort of nonsense that you get in America about stars. And it enables people here who are successful to keep their heads, I guess, but also it means that you're likely to have slightly more intense but normal conversations with lots of people.
Well, what are Midnight Oil going to be doing in 85, with Red Sails in the Sunset still in the charts in Australia, and it's getting some reaction around the world? Your political career, although it's taken a little nosedive, it's still maintaining its sanity. What will you and the rest of the band be up to this year?
Well, in the first half of 1985, the Oils are going off the road in Australia. We may be playing in other parts of the world, and that's something which remains to be seen. We'll be spending our time on the long-awaited Midnight Oil songbook and a film project which we've had on the boil for some time.
What's the songbook about? Is it simply you're going to print the lyrics of all your favourite songs and bind them into a book, or is it something different to that?
No, we want to do that. We want to get some of the songs in a book for people, because there's been a lot of requests for it. But as well as that, we want to include a bit of photos and snapshots and the other side of the Oils, I guess, backstage stuff and some of the travelling bits and pieces that we have, and maybe a few little running commentaries. It's a fans book for people that are interested enough to spend the money to find out about the songs and want to see something else as well. As well as that, we'll be doing our films and probably mixing a live album. And we will exist as a band that creates music and is concerned with the issues of disarmament, those other things which have concerned us. I've been approached to do some speaking engagement type things, going out and talking and being with people in New Zealand, which, as you know, has a anti-nuclear government at the moment, and which is coming under severe pressure from the United States to change its anti-nuclear policies. I'll be going over there to help them stem the tide, and I'm also been invited to Japan to speak to university students in Japan about peace and disarmament. So I'm going to do those sort of things, as well as be involved with the Oils, as well as start putting together some visual material for Australia and from the rest of the world about the issue. I'm really concerned that unless we take the debate about disarmament and about nuclear weapons out to people in a language that they understand and point out to them what the issues are, simply and practically and responsibly, And if musicians and bands and young people don't get involved in that process, I'm really concerned that the politicians of the world, the military leaders of the world, and the newspapers and business interests of the world will determine the way the debate is and will, in a sense, obscure the truth. I think the truth needs to be kept up there in front of us at all times, and I'm going to try and do that.
Since the late 70s, Midnight Oil has been a good forum, a good vehicle for yourself and the rest of the band to bring forward many of the ideas that you've been talking about in this interview. Do you think that the oils are going to stay around? Is it going to be one aspect of your expression of your beliefs for the future, or is it something that you might bring to an end in the next year?
The oils? I think as far as Midnight Oil goes, it's always difficult to talk beyond 6 months. I think for my own sake, it's not unreasonable for me to be say that I see the days of going out and touring extensively and playing to lots and lots of people and talking to radio stations about my favourite songs as coming to an end. I think we'll still continue to make music, and I would like us to play, especially in other parts of the world, for things which make sense. Now that we have had some degree of success, I don't find that it's compatible with my own political beliefs just to go out and make money by playing. I can't really do that. I think that if we're going to go out and play, we need to make a living from it, but I think we need to be doing it for a good reason. And if there aren't any good reasons to do it, then I don't think we'll do as much. As well as that, I detect that there's a very great need nowadays, a global need, for someone to communicate and talk about the issues which affect us all so directly, in a way which is understandable, in a way which is potent. And I want to read and think and talk and meet people and develop that facility so that I can go out and help, you know, everybody else who's out there trying to rescue this planet from its crazy course.